E-Y-C, Christen, C-H-R-I-S-T-E-N, and it is, we are at the Huntington Sheraton Hotel in Pasadena, California. We're in the lobby foyer, and it's Wednesday, the 28th of July, 1976, and it's approximately 1:40, and Harvey and I have been talking for about 2 hours. I've been talking an hour and 55 minutes and let him get 5 minutes in. And we've been talking about his days with Lockheed back in the 30s, and especially about one of Lockheed's customers, Amelia Earhart. Harvey's sitting here with me now, and I'm going to be we're going to try and round up some of the questions and things that we were talking about. I want to ask you a question. What does a C stand for?
Carl.
Carl. C-A-R-L?
Or Charlie, either one, yeah.
Okay. And I asked you just before I turned this tape on that about some magnesium parts that Amelia had used in her airplane when it was originally manufactured, and you were telling me about some of those things.
Right. Well, you know, magnesium, we were all a bit skeptical about where to apply it because of the corrosive characteristics of it. It was a great weight saver, but the airplanes that flew the Alaska area and the Central and South America area with Pan Am were near the salt water level, and the Navy, of course, too, were flying out of airports and facilities near the ocean. So we were very careful about where we applied them. And as far as 1055, that's Amelia's serial number, 1055E, as we called it, were concerned, the only possible places that it could have been used at that time were in housings for gearboxes, such as the flap gear mechanism and the landing gear transmission housing. Even there, though, with the Pan American fleet, we had choices to either treat them specially or replace them with the old duraluminum type castings. In most cases, we replaced them where they were subjected to that condition. So, far as Amelia's airplane is concerned, there were no, as far as I'm concerned, special efforts to put weight-saving magnesium castings in it because it was built during that period of where we were being very careful and cautious about using them, even for housings, as I said, for operating mechanisms. As far as primary structure is concerned, no. There was a lot of research going on in this area, but mainly by one of our competitors, Northrop, not ourselves. So bituminous paint was oftentimes used to protect the surfaces, and the dichromate treatment was used oftentimes, which is a process similar to anodizing or allodyne treatment. But it only protected the outer surfaces of these housings. Once the salt water got into the interior of a casting or a forging or a sheet metal part, the intergranular corrosion was immediate. The reaction was absolutely unsatisfactory as far as structure
use. So then as far as any magnesium parts being
used on her airplane especially?
Yes. There was really nothing except a few castings and whatnot. Nothing.
No, when I say castings, above all, don't relate it to any attachment castings or any fittings that had to do with putting the airplane together. The only place we were using them at that time were in housings.
Okay. So as far as the airplane being in salt water for any long period of time and the deterioration of that magnesium, structurally wouldn't have any bearing?
There wouldn't. There wouldn't be any magnesium, except the possibility always that there was a housing for the flap mechanism or something, and if that airplane could be recovered, of course, you'd soon find that out. You'd soon be able to verify that.
Earlier, we were talking about the windshields, and you were telling me that they used the type of glass that was used in those windshields. Could I get you to repeat that?
Yes. Our glass in those days came from Pittsburgh Plate, and they either cut the glass to our template, sent to the factory, or sent us the plates from which the local distributor or the local representative would cut to our templates. It was known as triplex. It was a, as the word implies, it was a three-lamination glass with a pliable plastic between, naturally, for shatterproofing characteristics. But it was optically very good glass. It was not exactly a plate. It was what they call a high-quality stretcher-leveled glass, but not a quarter-inch plate glass, obviously, because the total windshield thickness with the three laminations in those days was at the most a half inch, so you could see that you couldn't take a quarter-inch plate glass and make three laminations out of it with the plastic insert between them. You'd have about a three-quarter to one-inch windshield glass, which we did not have in those days.
But optically, it was very good.
Optically, very good,
and
very good glass.
Quite carefully.
Yes, we would visually check it. And for seeds, as we called them, and for bubbles and for distortions. But the glass manufacturer knew what we were using it for, so their preliminary checks would be to sort out the glass and give us a quality piece of glass before they even made a windshield out of it.
Do you remember in Amelia's airplane that they installed two windows on each side of the navigation compartment, especially? Do you remember anything about those?
Well, those were more like cabin glass. They were not of the same quality or the same thickness of a windshield glass. They did not have the frontal impact to contend with and so forth, the icing or the sleet or the hail or whatever their direct in-flight characteristics that were required for windshields would need. They were more of the cabin type glass, which would be also a laminated glass, in most instances a laminated glass, but of a very much lighter gauge or weight glass, and only two laminations.
Well, now, in her airplane, Noonan was going to be using those for celestial observation. Each window on each side. Was there any optical?
They could have had certain amount of optical distortion because they were curved in the first place. They were not an absolute flat glass, so when you have a curved glass, two of them, and you laminate, you form them as two pieces, and then you laminate them. Matching two curved surfaces with the plastic insert was the way you got a complete laminated side glass. So there could have been, it would be possible for some distortion on those side glasses because they were not of the same quality or spec requirement as a windshield glass.
Okay, now I want to ask you, I'm going to show you a couple pictures.
I might add, though, that in the case of having selected glass for their particular installation, it could be that they sorted out glass and looked at it visually to try to give them the best possible set of glasses.
We're looking at one of the pictures now, and it is obviously curved glass.
Yes, that's right.
That's on the starboard side.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of pictures here I want to show you and ask you questions about. I don't know where to start here. I've got my books coming apart.
There we go.
Let me set it down. I'll get each one of these pictures individually. Sorry, I'm so disorganized. Okay, here's an early picture of Amelia's airplane. This is the plexiglass dome housing on top. When the airplane first came out, it had that on it. Do you remember at all what that was?
No, I couldn't explain that. We gave them a basic airplane and certain parts of the instrumentation or navigational equipment was installed after delivery from us.
And
we didn't do all of the initial installations, no.
Okay, I'm going to show you a picture taken down in the cockpit with Amelia sitting in the co-pilot seat. And you'll notice the control wheel's all in there, and you'll notice that there is a control unit here. This has been identified. This is a control unit for a Western Electric receiver, remote control unit.
A sub-panel.
It's on this panel here. I'll give you a blow-up of it. Okay. Now, this unit here is part of the Western Electric remote control for receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what this unit is at all.
Well, it appears to me to be a remote control device that with a knob that turns and has an indicator and a dial that shows through a window it was not uncommon to have that type of indicating control on a panel. I'm just looking at the blow up now, and it would appear to me that there's a handle with a knob on it, and there's the knob, and there's a window for the reading to come through. Therefore, it would be the indicator would be indicating a position, the result of having moved or purpose of moving this handle. So therefore, I would say it was a remote control with an indicator that would we have used to indicate the position of some external device on the airplane. It could have been the suggesting the possibility that it had to do with a loop or a device that this would indicate its position on the dash.
Or even early receivers had
this type, except that the crank is of such size that it would appear to me that it is running a tack cable or something that required the amount of leverage and the amount of grip that if it were just a electrical device, they wouldn't need that that size of handle, and they wouldn't need that much leverage.
May I suggest that it might be a mechanical control for controlling the changing the transmitter frequency?
If it was a tack-type cable that went through the transmitter that in turn moved another device, yes.
I'll keep working on that.
Yeah, that type of installation was usually the maneuvering end of an extended length of tack cable or Bowdenite cable. We used the tack type cable, but we also used a Bowden cable. The Bowden cable usually was a forward and push and pull, but the tack was a rotating, and it was a reverse wound cable, as you know, to give it strength and reasonable accuracy. No, that panel, parts of it looked like it could have been, there's a lot of add-ons. From my point of view, when I look at a panel and I see a doubler plate with five switches on it, that's an afterthought. That's not an original, because we would make our original panels and cut the instrument location holes and the installation holes originally on a bench layout. This appears to me like an add-on, like it was an add-on
unit. Now, on the little direct view window here, there's a little thing that sticks out. Do you know what that is?
You
can't see it in this picture at all.
Yeah, well, there was a sliding latch, and that window was in many instances. You could open it, get it ajar. It was not an absolute, in all instances, permanently installed, fixed installed window.
See,
you could get ventilation. As you recall, we used to say the air moves forward in a fuselage, a Venturi-type action, and if you had a way of cracking the side window a little bit to let the air flow, well, you'd get ventilation.
And that little outside track was
just to keep it from coming out too far. It was a holding fixture.
All right,
no. I'm noting something here that goes to controls. I'm noting the cable control at the top of the cockpit.
That must either be a rudder or a trim tab
control, obviously.
Which it was, do you?
It would more than likely located there be a rudder tab control, we were able to, in many instances, accommodate the pilot and move them to where they wanted them, so that would not necessarily be restricted.
Okay, one question. You notice that this hatch opens
right
to the left.
Mm-hmm.
Later, that hatch was made to open the other way. And I guess that's because, rather than crawling over the tanks, she was coming up to the wing and entering the airplane that way. And was that why it was changed from here to up? The hinge is now in the center of the airplane later on.
And lifts upward instead of downward?
Yes, it went over, laid over on top of the co-pilot's head.
If it opened downward, she'd have to crawl over the hatch to get to the wing, and that would be a very hazardous thing. I would say that it was to make it feasible to get to the wing, to have the hinge line at the top center line of the airplane rather than the bottom.
Now, you see here where it says operator's handbook?
Yes.
Do you have any idea what that... You know, that's pretty wild that you'd recognize
sure.
that printing, but...
Well, there were basic handbooks on all of the aircraft that were a requirement that we kept in what we used to call the map case, or as a pouch, and I could see the fact that this one was a pouch, that it would be basic manual that had to do with controls, fuel systems, that you would insert basic instructions or diagrams so that they could follow the procedures.
Now, here's a picture that shows, I don't want to show this first, I want to show something else first. I'll start with this one. Here's a picture of a fuel tank installed.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll notice that how they're all
yep.
tied down
mm-hmm.
and everything, and the vent lines. It looks like the vent line comes up here to this cupper. Is that correct? It looks like the vents all come forward and are attached to a scupper at the filler point for the left and right hand forward tank.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see.
Do you remember the venting system at all?
Well,
it's only important in the sense that when the airplane had dished, how fast those tanks would fill full of water, kind of depending on the position
yeah,
of the vents.
Yeah. Well, of course, the basic requirement was to be able to vent the tanks so that when you did take the expend the fuel, you wouldn't get a collapse tank. In the case of expanding gasoline, if you filled on a cold night, as we used to on many a Bendix race, we always had to have a place for that expanded gas to go in the morning when the old sun come up on it. So the vent system was always put to the top side so that we wouldn't start a siphoning action if we ever did get the fuel, an overfill or an expansion. But I would say in this case that the normal place to put a vent system was on the top of a wing or on the top of a fuselage.
Okay. Now, you can see here that this vent comes
mm-hmm.
in here,
mm-hmm.
and this vent comes in here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a common vent manifold running forward.
Mm-hmm.
And then is vented up to the filler and the scupper, probably scupper
yeah.
drain
yeah.
on
mm-hmm.
the top there. So it's vented left and vented right. Do you have any idea what that is? It looks like a gauge, doesn't it?
Well, yes, but it's got a coiled... the only thing I'm thinking of is some form of a thermocouple, because it's not a coiled piece of plumbing, it's a coiled piece of wire, so it's an indicator. It was not uncommon to hang a remote reading instrument that had a thermocouple pickup or something. I can't visualize why you'd want a thermocouple in this area, but it looks again like it's a electrical cable coil rather than a piece of plumbing. Does it not to you, or would you say that
it looks like either string or wire, like you say?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now here's this piece of plywood put on top so that they can mm-hmm. crawl back and forth
right.
to the top
mm-hmm.
of it.
Right,
and here is a unit.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously a piece of radio equipment of
sure.
some kind, a
mm-hmm.
dynamo. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea what that piece of radio equipment is?
Well, again, I'd be reaching like you would. Is it by the amount of cable hookup here that I'm looking at, electrical cable hookup, and a what would appear to me either a coax cable or again a tack type cable, and then I'm looking at a what would look like an electrical motor, not a servo. It's too big for that. It would look like a... Could it be a transceiver of some kind?
Yes. It could be, it could be just the transmitter, or it could be a receiver. Bill Lierth thought it would look like an ARP receiver to him.
Yeah.
But
well,
I haven't enabled it.
There's certainly... it must have performed a rather, I'm again speaking as a layman, complicated function if you look at the mass of shielded cable that going into this unit.
Think more like a transmitter, by the way.
Transceiver, transmitter, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wire coming down. I'll show it to you in another picture.
Right.
By the way, you notice there's this filler's up here, this filler's here, and there's four tanks here. This mm-hmm. filler you can just barely see there, then you can see the second one. And there's kind of a space. And there's a third filler, and there's a fourth filler.
Mm-hmm.
The tanks used to be different. The tanks were wide, but they couldn't control which tank they were filling that way, so they made a change. And in the process, they made a dent. They had four holes with little covers right in a row on the left-hand side of the fuselage. Then they blanked the center one out, and they added a fifth one in the back. And they had two forward and two aft with the center one blanked out. That's when they went from this double manifold to
single manifolds.
Individual manifolds. And do you remember anything about that at all?
No, that would seem like an after.
Some people point out that that's a difference in the airplane.
No.
Well, it is a difference, but it's a difference that was done either before March or done during the...
Sure. There were, you know, when you pulled an airplane off the line to its basic configuration and you start introducing all the navigational equipment and all the equipment that was peculiar to the mission, you oftentimes had to modify the basic part of the airplane to receive it and use it.
Now I'll interject something else into the story. This is a picture here taken in Teterboro, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And this picture was taken while Amelia was back there in a flight. And this fellow here is a guy by the name of Curl Remlin, who worked for Bendix at the time. And on the way there, Amelia stopped in South Bend, Indiana, and saw Bendix and got $5,000 from him. And also, at that particular time, Bendix was putting Radio Corporation of America, Radio Research Corporation, and Hilliard of Chicago, and he was putting together a receiver, a transmitter, and a direction finder into, you know, all under one line, going to be the Bendix line.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be the Bendix RA1 receiver, the Bendix TA1 transmitter, and the Bendix RDF1 direction finder.
Mm-hmm.
And Remlin sold Amelia on using this equipment, and this is the number one RA1 receiver. Amelia said what frequencies he wanted it for, and I know that this unit was installed on her airplane between March 3rd and March 10th, 1937, just about a week or 10 days before she went to Honolulu. This was taken back in January or February. And this is Harry Manning here, who was sort of a radio man, even though he's a ship captain. And Noonan also accompanied him to Honolulu, as you know. But anyway, Amelia agreed to take this unit. And on March the 3rd, on February 25th, a fellow by the name of Moore and Malcolm Taylor shipped the unit by Air Express to Burbank, and Mr. Remlin showed up in Burbank bringing this unit with him from Washington on March the 3rd, and it's shown here in Burbank with Amelia. This is the direction finder loop, and this is the coupling unit that couples this to the RA1. This unit here, picture here, was taken. And you'll notice some changes between this picture and this picture. One of the major changes being, you'll notice that this stuff has been removed.
Yes.
This is identified as a dynamotor unit for
right.
an RA1 receiver.
Right.
This unit here, I'm not sure what it is. Just don't know. You notice here, all of this electrical wiring that was coming up to here has been removed, and the antenna mast has been moved. Now, is this a ventilator?
That's a vent. That's okay. Strictly a vent.
That was common to all lots.
Yes. Yeah.
And you notice here, this is a better view of our fuel vent line coming in up here, and we have the same thing.
Yeah, those are the forward tanks, obviously, though. We're looking at another series of tanks.
Yes.
Still
yeah,
here. Yeah.
These are the two forward, the left hand and the right hand. And there's a filler up here and up here.
There's also a black box in here.
Now, this is the fellow by the name of Joe Burr United built this. And this is a 500 kilocycle matching unit to match her 500 kilocycle transmitter to her little flat top antenna so she doesn't have to use the trailing wire. This picture might have been taken after the aircraft was repaired. Can you, any way you can think?
Well, remember there was quite a length of time that this airplane was housed over at the old United hangar at Burbank, which Paul Mance leased, and at which location Paul Mance, and Todd Oviatt was one of the men that worked with him, and other experts from the equipment side of the business spent a great deal of time and did modify the airplane and did do extensive work on many parts of the installation. And that was considerable length of time after the airplane was delivered from Lockheed. So there was a period.
You don't think that really Lockheed installed much of a regular
aircraft? Much of the, we installed the original basic equipment, but she went through so many changes and modifications as a result of the Honolulu attempt and then bringing it back, and then her continual relationship with the people, engineering and manufacturing these types of equipment, that I'm sure that the whole program was being constantly reviewed for possible improvement and updating. So there was work done at what we call the Paul Mance facility, Burbank.
Well, Paul doesn't have any radio, man.
No, but they were available to him, just like to anybody else, through the manufacturers of these equipment.
Well, this is probably part I have. Joe Gerr said he did not install. He installed this. But he did not install it. He thought it was done by Lockheed.
Well, there might have been some Lockheed men working for Amelia and Paul on a second shift or a released basis. It was not uncommon for people to be released to allow their know-how to be used by someone of this sort, where the airplane was being handled at another facility. This was done. So it's possible there were some Lockheed expertise loaned or used over there, but my office was not too far away from the Paul Mance facility, as we call it, the old United Airlines hangar at Burbank Airport, and I'd stopped by there on many occasions to see how things were going, and it was not uncommon to see specialists and experts from the engine shops, from the many accessory manufacturers giving support to Amelia's project. So I think that you might not find a radio man on the payroll of Paul Mance, but you'd find field service type people from these manufacturers there assisting.
Okay. Now, there was four vents on top of the airplane, 1, 2, 3, 4, and these little vents were facing aft, in other words, they were...
Yeah, that's correct.
And they were suction vents.
That's correct. They were not pressurized, they were suction.
Just aft of the, just forward of the door, there is a, just right up above the window here, on top, there was rather a large...
Scoop
thing, but it was facing forward. What was that?
Well, to get ram action, I'm sure.
In the aft.
Right, because the air circulated fore to aft is, if you did it aft to forward, generally in aircraft, that if you didn't pressurize, there get some action up on the front end, you were pulling the air forward and out that windshield. If you recall, I mentioned on the right the little window. So
it was quite a large scoop. Yeah. I'd say it was about as big as my hand and stuck up.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And that was a ram air scoop.
For the, nothing to do with it. Might have helped cool some radio gear. It might have helped cool some boxes.
It was actually right. It would be right above his head here. Right.
Okay. Here. Well, then it was strictly for ventilation purposes. Yeah.
Now, this is a navigation table they installed, and they installed an altimeter, you see, the temperature gauge, and airspeed indicator, and a little Polaris here. Mm-hmm. And this is Noonan's
station.
Do you recognize this here? That's kind of underneath.
Yes, it looks very much like a battery box to me.
That's their spare battery.
That's, I would say that was a battery box.
Do you notice here, this is very definitely a...
Yeah.
Now, just down underneath this thing is through the skin insulator where the antenna went out, and eventually.
Is that a coax lead?
I don't know whether it
is. Doesn't look coax. No, it's heavy shielding.
Heavy shielding.
Yeah. And it's also cut off right out of what appears to be a plywood platform.
Now, this is standard type of battery connectors that you were using.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's shielded. I don't understand why a battery cable would necessarily have that much shielding. Do you?
No, but that's what I figured it was.
It's it's got to be. It's got to be that, Tim. Well, here's the plug into the side on one of the hookups. Yes, it's. I can't see that it would be anything else but battery.
Now, trying to think of any other questions I had about it. You know if there's any pictures taken of the... At one time, for a while, Amelia evidently was having some trouble with her engine analyzer, fuel analyzer.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of the unit, but... it was the same one we had in the T-50s, the Bobcats. Anyway, for a while, below the compass here, it looks like she had moved the indicator, which was shown on your drawings of the panel down on here, and moved it up there, I guess so she could watch it while she controlled the mixture control.
Mm-hmm.
But during the flight, it had been removed. Do you know anything about why they did that? Or?
Well, if it was a single unit that she could... switch over from one engine to another.